This is Sean with Voices of SAE, and I'm speaking with Cortland Miller. Court, you were there when I was there, and you're now down in Plano, Texas. Is that right?
That's correct. Or is North Dallas suburbs.
Okay. You also are a spine physician. Is that right?
Yeah, I do interventional spine. I treat people with back pain and do different procedures for them, like different injections in their spine. Pretty much anything that we have surgeons in our group, but anything that's not surgery that's still procedure oriented or even just clinically oriented that's related to the spine, I do it.
Okay. And what pledge class year were you SAE?
I was 96. I actually, I don't know how many people you interview were in two pledge classes, but I was actually in two. I started in Beta Omicron in the fall and then got mono pretty early into pledgeship, about 2 or 3 weeks in, and ended up going home for the rest of the semester and came back in the spring and re-rushed again and went through in Beta Pi.
Okay. So where were you born?
I was born in Lima, Ohio.
And at what was like the path to Ball State? How did that happen?
When I was looking at colleges or was getting near the end of high school, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something in science, and my biology teacher was like, oh, you like mutants and weird stuff. You should look at genetics. And back in the 90s, there wasn't actually that many places where you could major in genetics, and Ball State happened to be on the list. And when I went around and looked at the schools, I thought it was a great medium size for me. It wasn't like too huge, but it wasn't small. And it was out of state, but it was actually only about an hour from my hometown because we were right on the Indiana border. So it allowed me to kind of get away from, have the feel of being like at an out of state school, but still close enough that if I had to come home and do the laundry, I could do it.
Okay. So when you got to Ball State, where did you first live? What dorm were you in?
I was in the honors dorm. I'm trying to think what it was called. I want to say it was called Schmidt-Wilson, but I'm not totally sure about that. It was right beside La Follette. I had a lot of friends in La Follette. I think it was called Schmidt-Wilson.
Schmidt-Wilson. So who were the first guys that kind of got you connected to the house?
It was actually just some dudes on my floor. I don't even think it was dudes that I ended up, you know, staying real tight with through college. It was just that they were going through Rush and didn't know anybody and wanted someone to go with them to Rush events. And I actually had no real urge to be in a fraternity, and went with them to some Rush events. And, you know, a lot of the houses I went to kind of reinforce why I didn't really want to be in a fraternity. And then we went through the SAE house and I met you, and you pulled me out of the Rush event over to your house, and we hung out in your room and watched a video of you skydiving. And I just felt and like just sat there and shot the shit all night and thought that you were super cool, and everyone I met were like normal people and not like you went to like some houses and everybody was wearing tuxes or suits. And I was like, this is not me. Went to and asked you what your dad did. I'm like, this isn't for me. Went to another house and it was like all ex-football players around the railing, pounding on the railing with their paddles. When you walked in for a Rush event, I was like, yeah, this is not me. And SAE seemed very like normal.
And to clarify,
dudes that like have fun, but normal dudes.
Yeah. And I want to clarify something. I lived in the big white Victorian house that is no longer there, right behind the backyard of the SAE house. So I wasn't trying to pull you down Riverside or any kind of weird stuff.
Hey man, come back and check out this cool video.
That's hilarious. All right. So
back then it was probably on a VCR tape.
It definitely 100% was. So who was our sweetheart and cook at that time?
So when I first started, Virginia was our cook for at least a year. And I remember you and her used to have some interesting conversations. Usually it was I'd walk into her just yelling, car, about something. And you were harassing her about something. But, and then we had through, while I was there, Barb and there was one other lady, I can't remember her name, but there was three cooks while I was there, and there was a real short time where we didn't have any cook at all. And then Sweetheart Wise, when I first started, was Kenna Knapp, who was Corey Miller's girlfriend at the time, I think. And I didn't know her super well. I mean, I knew her just because she was the sweetheart, but she was real attractive, and she was like a junior or something, and I was a freshman, so I didn't really talk to her much. But after her was Raquel, and she was kind of my class's sweetheart. She came up to the dorms with us. She was the same age as us, so like I knew Raquel really well, so I always thought of Raquel as kind of my sweetheart, or like my class's sweetheart. And then after her, I think, was Crystal Plew, potentially, and then Ginny Cabezzi.
Okay. All right, so what are some of the very first memories you've got of Pledship or Rush or coming into the house, just kind of the beginning fun stuff?
I mean, the beginning stuff, you remember, like, getting up at 6 a.m. to clean after a party, but or, like, the nasty smell in the bathroom while you have to bleach everything. But, I mean, some of the things that I remember that stick out to me during Pledship, you know, one thing that really I thought was awesome was the night where you recite The True Gentleman, where you got to memorize it. And I actually got it. Like, you go down in the basement and you do it, and it's a really stressful thing, and everybody's waiting. You can't mess up at all. And if you do it, everyone just erupts into this, like, you know, craziness. And it's such a cool feeling, and not many people got through the whole thing without screwing it up. And I just remember that rush of feeling, like, from that. And then the other things that probably stick out to me in my head were fun stuff like Lockout and chasing down actives to kidnap them. And for Lockout, they never fought you too hard because they all wanted to go in the end anyway. But they give you a hard time. And then what they would give you a hard time about is if someone got lavalier and you had to tree them, where we'd drag them to the house and tie them up down in the basement and throw a bunch of nasty stuff on them. And then have their girlfriend come over and we'd sing to them while they were tied up. And people did fight you for that because nobody wanted to be treed. And people would hide that they lavaliered someone for a long time because they didn't want to get treed. And I remember Phil Schombach, I think it was, when we did him, he was like a wrestler in high school, like a real high-level wrestler or something. And he was tough. It took many guys to bring him down and sling him up to the pole. And, yeah, dudes fought tooth and nail against that. But stuff like that, you know, we did fun stuff for fundraisers. I mean, we did a Habitat for Humanity thing, and, you know, a lot of us would go donate plasma for money. I think Boedeker was the king of that, though. That guy could, like, squeeze his elbow where the hole was where they put the IV in for plasma money, and I think he went like twice a week, every week, and he could just like pinch his elbow and it would start bleeding. Like they could just slide that needle right in there. He'd been there so many times for $20 for beer money for the week.
All right, well, but how about some like outside of campus scenarios, brothers going away together? I think you've got one about Brown County.
You know, I don't think I ever went on a Brown County one.
No.
I think that was the Omicrons right before us.
Okay.
We did our lockout to University of Illinois, I think. And that house was, you know, it was fun. You'd go to another house to party for the weekend. Usually they would call the house ahead of time, tell them we were coming, so they would have a party or something. And, you know, usually you don't – it's funny when you go to other schools, you don't realize, like, how different houses can be at different schools. And the SEs at U of I – when we went, if I remember right, we're like really into techno and rave stuff, and they had like a pretty wild party, but it was a totally different atmosphere than our house.
All right, so what's some of the funny things you just remember happening, like, you know, in between other fraternities and, you know, just stuff at the house? Because I'm sure you've got a few you could kind of rattle off.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the houses were always constantly harassing each other. Like, you know, the Sigma Chi's had that cross out in front of their house, and that was white, and that thing got like gasoline poured on it and lit on fire. People painted it like Gumby. Someone tried like hooking a car. I don't think we did this one, but someone hooked a car up to it and took off, and it actually ripped the bumper off the car. And they finally, like, had a pledge sitting there 24 hours a day watching it to make sure nobody did anything to their cross. And then, like, the SIGAPS got picked on quite a bit. They were kind of nerdier house. They kind of was the brunt of a lot of pranks and snowball fights. I remember there was a big snowball fight down Riverside that ended up in the SIGAP house, and it was basically the entire Greek row against SIGAP.
To clarify on that one, it was Simakai across their driveway to Beta, then Beta and Simakai to SAE, then SAE and Simakai and Beta to Delts, then the four of us to the Dekais, then the five of us to the Lambda Kais, then the six of us to the SIGAPS. I remember that very clearly. That was hilarious.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was always crap going on. I remember the Sigma Kais had their crest, like, right in front of their front door, and during parties, you'd go over to other people's house, and it was always a little dicey going over to someone else's house for a party, unless you, like, knew a lot of the dudes. And they put their crest, like, right in their front door. So they would, like, make everyone walk around it. And I remember me and Hensley, I think, coming out of there just hammered. And, like, we looked at each other and both, like, danced around on it. And, like, I thought we were going to get killed. They threw us out. I don't remember a whole lot of that night, but I do remember doing that or jumping on it. Like, when they were making everybody, like, walk around it on the way out. I'm like, why would you put this in your front door if you don't want people to step on it? But, yeah, I mean, it's all in good jest.
Okay, all right. So you being able to listen to active interviews, do you see how that would be, you know, getting the now perspective and also what their success is? What do you think about that and that aspect of this whole project?
You know, I have not gotten to explore the website that much yet, so I have not listened to the active interviews, but I definitely plan on doing it. Because, yeah, I mean, the whole environment is way different. I think Ball State's completely dry now, if I'm right when I heard it. So even just the party scene and, like, everything has got to be completely different than when we were going through, when it was a little more wild, I think.
Right.
And even before us, the guys in the 80s, like, or even wilder than that. I mean, everybody's got their stories.
Well, I think that, you know, people being able to hear what people are doing now, but also what the guys are doing on campus and their successes and stuff, I think it's going to help bridge a lot of networking between both sides. And so what would be, you know, if you were going to describe to an incoming freshman that would rush, you know, what really makes SAE, and how has it really benefited you, like, after college? And was there ever a situation that you really helped out, you know, another brother after college?
Yeah, so I think, you know, going back through it then, one great aspect of Greek life in general is you get tossed into basically an instant family, and you know, you may disagree with people, and people have their issues and dramas and stuff, but in the end, they're your brothers, and you stick up for them, and it's an instant group of friends and brothers, and, like, it made the school a lot more manageable size-wise, because you go to class, and just being in the Greek system, you knew so many people from different stuff that you'd say hi to, like, 10, 15 people on the way to class, and just because you end up knowing so many people. And so, yeah, you definitely, it's great from a networking aspect later in life, and yeah, you never know who's going to pull through for you. I mean, my training and background of what I do in medicine, my residency was in physical medicine and rehab, and that is especially where you take care of a lot of people with spinal cord injuries, strokes, traumatic brain injuries, traumas, amputations. And you know, I think just getting done with training, or might have even just gotten done at Emory in Atlanta. And Atlanta has one of the top spinal cord injury hospitals in the country, the Shepherd Center. And one of our brothers that was in the year, I think he was a year ahead of me, Dave McCauley, got injured with a pool accident and had a cervical spinal cord injury and had quadriplegia, or has quadriplegia from it. And when it happened, I don't remember who got a hold of me. I think it was Jen. I think her either maiden name or her married name now is Ruckel. She was an Alpha Phi, I think. She was out in Colorado, but was real good friends with Dave even after school. And somehow through Facebook or something, she knew I was a doctor. I don't think knew that I was in the specialty that I was, but she called me, and I think Chad maybe, or she gave my name to Chad, and Chad, Dave's brother, called me and, you know, asked me if I knew anything about his injury. And like, and I was able to pretty shortly after his injury get him hooked up with the Shepherd Center. And I can't remember, but I don't think he had insurance at the time, but they do a few charity cases every year for people without insurance, or a decent amount of charity cases. And we were able to get him connected to come down there to Shepherd Center and do his rehabilitative stay there immediately after his injury, pretty early in his injury course. And spinal cord injury is one of those things that it dramatically changes how your body works. And if you're not in an environment that is familiar with the types of problems those patients can have, you can end up with a lot of medical issues, even really on. And so being able to be in a specialty hospital like that, that's whole things built around people like that had the problem he had, I think allowed him to really, you know, make the most out of when life hands you lemons and you make lemonade and kind of get back to life. And, you know, since then, he's become a big advocate for people with spinal cord injuries. He started a charity. I think he's got like a company that is involved with art that he makes that raises money for awareness and increases awareness. And yeah, you know, right after his injury, he moved to New York, which as a city would be a very difficult city to live in, even if you don't have impairment. And even as a quadriplegic, I mean, he thrived in New York, man. Like he seemed like he really had a good time in New York. And I didn't keep too close to touch with him over the years. I haven't talked to him in a good while, but it seemed like he did really well afterwards, from a really horrific situation.
Yeah, he ended up going to Miami and having an art, let's call it art gallery down there, as well as I think in Brooklyn and possibly one out in Denver. And he like made the Miami Herald, well, you know, like front covers of things, and he, you know, got awarded things at giant, you know, huge celebrity events and all this stuff. So he really kind of is taking that to a whole nother level of awareness for, you know, disabled and whatnot. But so anyway, is there anything else you'd like to just kind of add in general about SAE?
Well, and that's a great point. Like you never know who, you know, like it just happened to be luck that I was in a specialty that did that thing. And that was the thing he needed right then. And like, you never know who in life, like down the road, years later, that you're going to need them for that one thing that they're an expert in. And I think an experience like being a fraternity and having friends and that many in college that you get exposed to so many different people and so many different things, like you never know down in life when it's going to, you're going to pull that back for, you run into them and just, you happen to run into them at the right time at the right place and help you out with that thing you need. And I think that's something that you get a lot more of that than going through college, not doing it and having your like couple friends that are like best friends, but you know, you've got a real close, small group, but just being part of something bigger like that just gives you such a wider net that you never know who you're going to help out or who you're going to need help from down the
right.
road.
That's a great point. Well, Phi Alpha, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and you know, looking forward to you being able to hear the other guys and even the actives. But I'm going to close this one out, and I really appreciate the time. Thanks, Court. Phi Alpha.
Yeah, man. Thanks, Phi Alpha.
You got it. All right, stay on the line.